Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC. Transformation that works. With the tech to stay ahead and the know-how to act. Visit pwc.ie to learn more.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Emmett Oliver, and this is the show that looks at business and politics from a wider perspective. And coming up, tariffs. We get the latest from CNN's economy reporter about how it's all playing out stateside. Later in the show, we'll be asking, what is the ultimate destiny of the silver euro? And there's this.
Someone's hiding in the bushes with a telephoto lens, while their editor assures them means justifies the ends. 'Cause we only hunt celebrities, it's just a bit of fun. But scousers never buy the sun.
Yes, Billy Bragg's Never Buy the Sun. Yes, we'll be talking about Liverpool as a new book comes out, looking at the famed English city and telling us what it tells us about Britain at large. You can, of course, email the show at takingstock@newstalk.com. But now, I believe I was a bit out of contact during the week, but I'm told there was some kind of event in the Rose Garden or something going on during the week. Well, as we know, we have a now brave world, a new economic order based on tariffs by the United States with its main trading partners. Every single country almost in the world getting a lash of the tariff stick from President Trump during the week. We saw them ranging from 10% for the UK right up to 46%, an eye-watering amount of money or percentage-wise on Vietnam. And are we now going to be sinking into a persistent and long-term global trade war? And I'm joined on Taking Stock today by Elizabeth Buchwald, who is the CNN's economy reporter. Elizabeth, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
A very busy week for you on your brief, and you've obviously been watching developments closely. Let's just get a sense of what was things like during the week that's just gone. What was the atmosphere like in the Rose Garden, and what are ordinary Americans saying and reacting to all of this?
It has been a fun week. I've gotten a lot of sleep. I'm just kidding. It's been a lot. Look, Trump is picking a trade war with the entire world. That's not an exaggeration. That's just a fact based on the tariffs that he's put out there. The only countries that are able to escape some tariffs for now with fine print are Mexico and Canada. Everyone else is being subjected to tariffs right now. We're seeing stocks not liking it. CEOs are very afraid. And it's really essentially closing the U.S. off to a lot of trade. Trump, of course, hopes that it will bring more manufacturing to the U.S. That might take some time. So there's going to be a lot of ramifications that happen. And it's going to be a busy few weeks, months, years covering all of this for sure.
Yeah, now, for me anyway, my own personal analogy on this is like somebody putting their hand in a fire. You know, most people will take their hand back out pretty quickly, but it seems President Trump is going to go on with this for a while. We don't really know. He says it is subject to negotiation. But did you notice during the week what he said was a little bit different to what some of those around him have said? Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, he sort of seemed to portray it all as kind of like an opening shot in negotiations, and this was the worst it was going to get, and now governments had to kind of come and make a pitch to President Trump. So we do seem to have two slightly different versions, the public version and then the interviews on places like CNN and Bloomberg, where the people around him sort of take the temperature down a little bit. Is that your sense of things?
Yeah, so if you're noticing, I don't want to call them inconsistent messages, but different messages that are getting out there that might not align altogether, that's not a coincidence. We had our own reporting out that plans were being readied in the 11th hour. And although Trump had said before the big Rose Garden event that he had committed to a plan, our reporting indicated otherwise, and that advisors were still presenting him with various proposals and that it had not been settled on.
Yeah, so I mean, you're saying it's not necessarily this was a long-term plan thought out. That's probably not a surprise to a lot of our listeners. But do you sense that if the likes of the EU, the UK, some of these other governments come, meet, talk with the Trump team, that there is still some room for negotiation here? Or do you think he just simply, for political reasons, has to ride out whatever storms come his way, the stock market or otherwise, over the next few weeks? I mean, what's your sense of where the Trump administration in broadly, it's obviously centered around one man, but there are others in the cabinet. How do you see that all playing out? Like, is this still a bargaining chip scenario? Or are we into something different in your view?
Look, it's a question that's on everyone's mind right now. Will there be negotiation? And we've heard from various administration officials, and Trump himself has kind of cast a view that some parts are open to negotiation. At least he's been meeting with world leaders. I mean, if he had no interest in negotiating at all, why take up the meetings? Of course, the countries that are being tariffed aren't just sitting and doing nothing. They're readying up plans to retaliate. In fact, many are already taking those steps. So I think maybe we'll see negotiations. I don't know for sure, but it seems like if there's a dialogue going on, then perhaps that could lead to something. But it's too soon to say.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, that why take the calls if you're not interested in the content of the call? I think it's a very strong point. What I'd also like to ask you is just the reaction among your live there, ordinary Americans. I mean, obviously, they've seen their investments being really incinerated over the last 24 hours in terms of share values, depending on if you've got a lot of money tied up in that area. I know the polls show that right across both parties, there's quite a lot of resistance to the idea of having a big tariff regime. So could you give us some sense of how the public are reacting? I mean, what's just sort of, I understand you can't summarise the views of 300 million people plus, but what's your sense of the sentiment since all this was announced?
Well, I mean, anywhere I go, I'm hearing about tariffs. In the elevator in my apartment building, I hear about tariffs. Everyone is talking about it. I hear it on the local news. I mean, it is just everywhere we go, subways. People are generally afraid. And this is coming at a time when the U.S. economy and much of the global economy is still recovering from the highest inflation rates that we've seen since roughly the 1980s. Even before Trump came back to the Oval Office, we were seeing that consumers were facing a bit of more of a crunch, I would say, and their finances toughening out and the job market kind of worsening. So none of this feels good, I will say, for consumers. Now, there's also the upside. There is an upside to tariffs, I guess, for some people. If you own an American company, in a certain sense, I mean, many companies, even if they're American, they're still importing stuff from other places. But we saw at the Rose Garden event that there were plenty of business leaders that were cheering him on, and they could see some more extra business. As Trump has said, tariffs are zero in the US.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that part, the protected will be, you know, kind of joyful at the way the direction of policy is going. But if you look at someone like Boeing, I was astounded during the week to see that at least 20% of its parts in assembling a plane come from outside the United States of America. You know, this ultimate national champion of America is still very dependent. So even those ones that were in the Rose Garden, maybe when they check their inventories and so on, they might find that they get a lot of stuff from outside the US that is going to be a lot more expensive.
I'm sure they're aware of all of that. We've become a global economy, and that has benefited a lot of countries for sure. And, you know, to give you one example, there's no such thing as an American car right now. We've functioned, the auto market here has functioned without borders from, within North America because we've had free trade deals in place. But now cars are being tariffed at 25% here. And look, parts cross the border so many times from Mexico and Canada. And, it's just functioned without a border. So I think CEOs are very aware of exactly what is coming from where, but it's a matter of how much more expensive things will get. And I think there's going to be a lot of reshuffling in supply chains. But then it's like, is it even worth making a big move if another tariff could soon be enacted on a country you move to. So that's a big problem facing businesses right now.
Talking about the mindset of Americans, I was watching some people commenting on during the week. Essentially, what Donald Trump is trying to get people to do is say, look, there's a short-term pain, but there's a medium-term gain. Yes, the stock market will dip and certain companies won't be happy and there will be a bit of grumbling, to put it mildly, among consumers. But on the other side of all this is extra jobs and more manufacturing coming back and all the rest of it. But Americans that I know, and I know quite a lot of them, I don't remember them being very long-term thinkers. I generally think that that's going to be a hard political thing to sort of roll out, that just sort of take a snooze for 6 months and, you know, we all come back and see this great nirvana in front of us. So that's going to be a tough sell, isn't it, politically? You've got midterm elections next year. You've already had a few in Florida and that judicial one in Wisconsin. So can Donald Trump just say, look, everyone can grumble away for a while, but there's a reward at the end of all this? Is that really going to be sustainable?
Look, what I will point you to is the economy continually, every election cycle, we see that ranking as the top issue for voters. You know, there's the old adage here, it's the economy, stupid. So if the economy is not looking as good as it did when he first went into office, I don't think voters will forget that.
Yeah, I suppose he has the two advantages there. One is he doesn't need to run again. We know some people say he might. And secondly, that midterm election is November of next year. So it is a good distance. So I don't know any more than you, but maybe he feels that, you know, I've got a bit of a clear runway for a while politically so I can take more risk than usual. Maybe that's the calculus.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair assessment.
Now, you've been talking to a lot of people who are looking at the sort of way these figures were assembled, economists and people who look at trade flows and so on. They don't seem to be, based on your article that you've written, they don't seem to be overly impressed or too convinced by the structure of these figures. Can you tell us a little bit about what they were saying to you?
Yeah, there's been a lot of questions on how the administration arrived at them. Now, there was supposed to be about a 2 month long investigation. It could be very much out there and I missed a link, but I haven't seen the big investigation that was directed by the Commerce Department. That's not to say that one wasn't happening, but in many regards, I was kind of expecting to see this like big report come out with, you know, this is what we investigated. And again, just because I didn't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but I didn't see one. So there were all sorts of questions on how the administration arrived at these numbers, which they say take into account non-tariff trade barriers. So they consider currency manipulation, a whole slew of other things. And it's like, how do you calculate, you know, a tariff rate based on, even if a country is, which, you know, it's all accusing. I don't know that there's always evidence that you could point to that says, you know, yes, this country's a currency manipulator. But putting that aside, how do you then calculate what you believe is a fair tariff rate on that? And there weren't too many answers on, you know, this is how much that led to this. I could go on and on, but yes, lots of questions that I think haven't been answered yet.
Sure. And then finally, one of the things that a lot of people are struck by is obviously we're in the European Union, so we have a parochial focus on that. But the sheer scale of the tariffs levied on poorer countries, you know, 46% for Vietnam. There's a lot of other countries that are also hit very hard that would be quite poor in terms of sort of per capita income traditionally. Is that getting any kind of coverage in the US? Places like Cambodia and so on? Obviously, the US sees China as its traditional economic rival, but a lot of other countries in Asia, smaller places, are being really hit savagely here. Is that being in any way resonating at all in the US, or is it just seen as overseas countries and they're kind of being put together in one group?
Yeah, I mean, it has been covered quite a bit. What's also been garnering a lot of attention is uninhabitable islands. I'm sorry, I'm like laughing here because this part is just so outlandish in many regards, but they're being tariffed and it's like, what are we even getting from there? Yes, there is a lot of discussion going on about how poor countries are going to be impacted by this. And there's all sorts of forecasts out there about Does this increase the odds that the US economy falls into a recession? There's just as many reports that I'm seeing about how other countries' economies can be impacted and whether they are inching closer to a recession too.
Yeah, I suppose it's the ultimate proof, isn't it? We all get poorer at the end of these trade wars when they're on a long-term basis. Listen, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks for walking us through from what's happening in the Rose Garden right through to how the statistics were compiled in a slightly peculiar way. Thank you very much, Elizabeth Buchwald, who is CNN's economy reporter, for joining us on Taking Stock.
Thank you.
Now, coming up next here on Taking Stock, we'll be talking about the trillion euros sitting in retirees' bank accounts. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock, and I want to talk this week about a fascinating report which has been released by Goodbody Stockbrokers looking at wealth ownership by demographics here in Ireland. And not surprisingly, I suppose, on one level, it tells us the older you are, the more wealth you have accumulated. But the sheer scale of it is fascinating. 295 billion euros in accumulated wealth held by, well, I'm going to say more seasoned citizens might be the best way to put it. There's probably not a big surprise, but a lot of it in property, but also in investments and business wealth also making up that amount. Joining me now to discuss the implications of it are Ciarán Hancock, business editor at the Irish Times, and I'm also joined by Sinead Ryan, who is, of course, a News Talk presenter and consumer expert. You're very welcome to Taking Stock. Ciarán, if I can go to you first, I suppose older people generally have more money, but the sheer scale of this must even have surprised you. And the big question, of course, arises of where is this money?
Yeah, hi, Emmett. That's right. It's a big figure. As you say, Goodbody did this report on inheritance and tax issues around it. It's kind of a guide for people who might be thinking about that. And what they discovered is they did some deep dive analysis into how much wealth there is in the country. So overall, they decided that as a nation, we have wealth of, as people, we have wealth of 1.2 trillion euro, which is a huge sum of money, hard to comprehend. But within that, what they call retired households have some 295 billion euro in wealth. Now, a lot of this is tied up, as you might imagine, in housing. And retired people, again, you know, pretty much they've paid off their mortgages. They would own the properties outright. So some 201 billion euro of that amount is tied up in housing. There's another 51 billion on deposit, 20 billion in financial investments, which would be stocks, shares, bonds, etc., and 23 billion in business wealth, so businesses that these people might own. And the interesting thing is that retired people make up 16% of the population, but they now hold 27% of the net wealth, according to this Goodbody analysis, and that's likely to rise for a couple of reasons in the coming years. One is because house prices just seem to only go one way, and that's upwards. So the housing stock will increase in value over time. But also because retirees are going to make up a larger percentage of the population. The Central Statistics Office expects it to grow to 26% of the population by 2047. So I suppose no great surprise, maybe in one way, that retirees have a higher percentage of the net wealth than their percentage of the population, because young people, young adults and children, teenagers, etc., don't tend to have much by way of financial assets. But it still is noteworthy. And, this is a lot of money that's going to be passed on to family or others over the next two decades.
Yeah, and obviously proper planning will swing into effect here, Ciarán. I mean, is there any sense that maybe this money could be more productively used? I suppose that opens up a difficult debate, a sensitive debate about, you know, people maybe shouldn't be in the home they're currently in, which people understandably will resist. But is there a debate there about how can this money be deployed more widely in the economy in more productive areas possibly?
They don't really go into that necessarily in the report. It's a 78-page report by Goodbody's. There's kind of one page on the wealth of the nation, if you like, and the rest of it then is a guide to the tax rules that apply around wealth and transfer inheritance and transferring assets and family farms and governance and all of that kind of stuff. There's just the one page on wealth. I'm not a tax expert, so I won't go there as to how people should deploy their money or how they should distribute it tax efficiently.
Yeah.
But there certainly are a lot of tips and guides. And Goodbody are saying, you know, they're not a tax advisor either. So they're also saying that people really should take some good tax advice on this, because it's a heck of a lot of money and you want to make sure that it's productively.
Yeah, the reason finished. I say that is just that the 51 billion, as you point out, on deposit earning a lot of, well, some of it will be earning interest, but most of it will be dead money. I suppose the banks want to hold on to it and lend it out their own way, but maybe there's something that can be done there. But again, it's people's money. They will decide ultimately. Let me bring Sinead into the conversation. Sinead, I suppose, as Ciarán points out, you know, as you get older, you accumulate more wealth, your liabilities start to come down. Is there anything here for you that would concern you, or is this just the normal pattern you'd expect to see and we're just in line with most of the European states?
Hi, Emmett. Well, the concerning thing about it is, I suppose, that this is the very last generation that is likely to have this amount of wealth, because a lot of it was generated, yes, from property and housing, the report shows that, but also from gold-plated pension schemes that were ran rampant, really, in the 70s, the 60s, 70s and 80s. And while these are still in the public sector and the civil service, they have all but disappeared from most companies. So employees now won't get to enjoy those absolutely whopping lump sums and guaranteed pensions and all of that. So what it would be concerning about using it or utilising the money, I mean, in terms of the household savings on deposit, there's actually 130 billion overall. It's just this generation owns the lion's share of it. Now, it's very, very difficult to advise those people on what to do with it other than sticking it in the bank and saving it. Now, if the banks don't want it, I mean, you know, the credit unions definitely don't want it because they have too much on deposit. But it's very hard to say to an 80-year-old widow, you should be sticking that in stocks and shares and making a few bob in it. You cannot do that. So instead, it's left in safe, structured financial instruments like state savings and deposit accounts. Inflation is eating its way into it. So the buying power of that is being lost every single year. We know inflation was very, very high in the last couple of years. But really, it's very difficult to see how else it could be utilised.
Yeah, because it's very frustrating, though, isn't it? Because when you go overseas, you meet Americans with their 401ks, you meet British people with their ISAs, you meet people in continental Europe who have various products. So I don't know. We just seem to be lacking imagination. I'm not saying the older people should be forced into anything or kind of have their wealth taken off them in some way. But it just seems like a lot of money that could be deployed, as you say, something that's less at risk of inflation and put into the productive part of the economy. But again, it's only government that could coordinate that, I suppose, in the end of the day.
Yeah, but also I get asked all the time, Emmett, when, you know, by people, where can I put my money that'll get me a really good return that's very safe? And the truth is, you have to pick one or the other. And if you have older people who, remember, have lived through not one, but at least two recessions, they are disinclined to take any risk at all with their money. They may need it for healthcare in the future. They may need it for care at home in the future. And they want to be able to pass it on to children, because we have a cultural hang-up about property, about inheritance and about passing on things to the younger generation, not so in the UK to at all the same degree or in the States. So, you know, you have a lot of hurdles to get through there. But also, you were quite right by pointing out this is their money. They have built it up, rightly or wrongly, through government policies that were in place at the time and through the way the economy worked over the last 50 years to be in this position. I don't think it's fair to say to them, listen, the rest of us need it now. Can you pass it on? Of course you can do that. You can do it by taxation. But it'll be a mightily brave government and finance minister that starts taxing older people more than the rest of the population. So part of this, and one of the biggest issues out of this is what is causing inflation in the housing market. It is these houses that are growing most in value. It is this money tied up that is causing house prices, because the government doesn't want to bite the bullet on in terms of massive building projects that we should be doing all over the place, because it is these voters, these older people, these are Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael voters. They have their house, thanks very much. And they don't want 300 apartments going up beside them.
Sure. Let me bring Ciarán back in on this. Ciarán, obviously, as you point out in your article and also the report points out, this is going to be passed on. It's a generational transfer of wealth. So a lot of people are going to be quite wealthy by not necessarily doing a whole lot for the money, just because mum and dad are going to pass it down the line. That's a fairly strong theme in this report, is it?
It is, yeah. And there's also mention that, you know, policymakers should be looking at some way in which some of these family homes, you know, you might have one or two elderly people, let's say, living in a large family home, that there might be some way in which we can unlock that without them necessarily being being taxed to the hilt, or some way of freeing up money for the next generation without being taxed to the hilt. But whether that happens or not, I don't know. You talked about initiatives that other countries have around savings, and we had an SSIA scheme in the Celtic Tiger years, which was kind of money for old rope, really. And there was an expectation last year that Michael McGrath might introduce some ISA-style investment products to try and unlock some of this money. There was an expectation it might happen in the budget. It never did. We're still waiting for that, so we'll see if anything comes of that. One other point to make is that a lot of retired people prior to the 2008 crash, they had a lot of their, or some of their wealth at least, tied up in bank shares because they figured that they were the safest houses, the likes of AIB and Bank of Ireland and other domestic institutions that were around at the time. And then, of course, the crash came and that money was completely wiped out. So there's a bit of scarring there in terms of, you know, putting money into stocks and shares.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah, it's a sort of, you're right, it's going to stay in the folklore for a long time. Sinead, the other way that possibly people could get on an individual level some of this money out, if they want to get it out, they live in a house, they want to stay living in that house, but there is things like equity release. I know they're not necessarily great if you just put down the amount of money you release versus what the lender is getting, but nevertheless, it does throw off cash. Is that possibly a product that's going to grow as we become older?
I'm not so sure. I mean, equity release is a very specific product. It got really bad press the last time it was here because in some cases, these lifetime loans where you don't make payments during your lifetime, the interest rolls up and you pay it back after you're dead. And the problem was that in the older versions of those, the loan surpassed the value of the house and the families were left with the bill. Now, the current product that's available doesn't do that. But it gives you a very, very small amount of the value of the house, depending on your age. You can only access it once you're over 60, in return for quite a hefty interest rate. It's about 6.7% a year. So that loan will double about every 9 or 10 years. Now, if you are planning on leaving that to children, or maybe you need it for Fair Deal, or you need it for your future health needs, or your retirement to supplement your pension, yes, you might get a lump sum to do maybe retrofit your house or go on a trip or whatever, but you have to be aware of the wider consequences of that. They're not terribly good value.
Now, the reason I'm asking is because you've got a lot of people who are going to be asset rich, but they're going to be cash poor. They're going to be sitting in a house that's worth €1 million, but they can't turn the lights on because they've got electricity bills coming in. So I'm saying that's where the hunger for this product might come in that area.
I get that. And the banks do not service this market because they don't want to lend to pensioners in the main. So it's very, very difficult for this group to access credit if credit be needed. Now, of course, what the government wants them to do is sell the house, move to something smaller, right-sizing it's called, not downsizing, and free up your money that way. What the government could do, if it wished, is incentivize people to do that. And maybe help pay for retrofitting, or you know, in a smaller house, give higher grants if people are prepared to give up a bigger house to do that, or if they really want to offer credit to this group, they, you know, I've been a long advocate of a form of state bank that allows that to happen. In other words, the state takes the hit where banks are not prepared to and cannot, and allows people to maybe entertain in the retrofitting projects. We're trying to get, I don't know how many houses retrofitted, and it is these older homes, the bungalows down the country, the old council houses, they're precisely the ones we're trying to target. So incentivize people, give them the credit and take it out of the house at a later stage. I don't see why we can't do more in that area.
Okay, some interesting ideas. 201 billion tied up in housing, 51 on deposits, 20 billion other investments, and the rest on business wealth. There it is, folks. Let's see where it goes over the next 5 or 10 years. Thank you very much for joining us. That was Sinead Ryan, of course, a consumer champion and personal finance journalist, and Ciarán Adcock, business editor of the Irish Times. Thank you both for joining us on Taking Stock. Now, this is Emmet Oliver here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we'll be talking about Liverpool and the unmaking of Great Britain. Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock. Now, if there's one city close to many people's hearts outside this country, you'll probably know this next city I'm going to talk about. It's blue or red teams garner support here when we all look to have family connections to the Fab Four. Yes, Liverpool is probably the most Irish city in Britain, but it's also had a tough 20th century and the last few decades, despite all the theatrics on the pitch, haven't been easy. And it's the subject of the theme of the next fascinating guest I have with his book, and that is Sam Weatherall, who's written a new book called Liverpool and the Unmaking of Britain. You're welcome to the programme, Sam.
Fantastic. Great to be here.
Listen, as I said, we don't need to introduce Liverpool. I'd say maybe 70-80% guesswork have been there of our listeners already. Obviously, it's produced probably the world's most famous and decorated band. But apart from that, you've got under the skin of the place and had a look back over its history and its whole sort of post-industrial landscape that we're all familiar with. We know what happened during Brexit. So there's a lot of stuff here to unpick. But just tell me, what attracted you into the history of Liverpool?
Yeah, that's a great question. So historians of Britain as a whole, people that write about kind of the big narratives of British history, have tended to kind of ignore Liverpool, and seen Liverpool as kind of exceptional to the rest of Britain, you know, for kind of obvious reasons, right? The city has often marketed itself or often carried itself as being opposed to the rest of the country, right? It has a very distinctive economy through the docks, very different to the economy of the rest of the country, has very different types of Black and Chinese settlement. Its Black and Chinese communities are much older than those in the rest of the country. So there's many reasons why, you know, Liverpool's been seen as exceptional. But I actually argue in this book that we should see Liverpool as central to British history. And actually, it's an argument that our present moment, you know, a bit of a bleak story, our present moment of kind of, declining standards of living, unraveling infrastructures of care, kind of shrinking political horizons. This moment that we're currently living in demands a new history of Britain and actually demands that we revisit Liverpool's history and put Liverpool back into the heart of how we understand British history.
Now, let's just get into for a second. Maybe I'll sort of dispose of this particular piece, but the golden years of Liverpool, we're obviously going to talk about Beatlemania. You had Cilla Black. You had that whole era of a particular Mersey sound, etc. Was that just a music thing, or was that part of some other wider renaissance in the city? I've always tried to puzzle that out.
Yeah, it's a great question. So the 1960s was actually a kind of a decade of prosperity in Liverpool, kind of in between two long phases of economic catastrophe, the Great Depression and the immediate post-war period on the one hand, and then obviously the 70s and the 80s afterwards. But what was so interesting, actually, is that during the peak of Beatlemania, right, Liverpool didn't really know what to do with the Beatles. Liverpool obviously was very proud of the Beatles, and the Beatles returned to the city and hundreds of thousands of people turned out, and it was an amazing kind of moment in 1964. But the city never really imagined that Beatles-related tourism would be a solution to the city's economic crisis. But, you know, the city was at that time trying to court light industry, court car workers. It was very interested in reviving a particular kind of industrial base. And ironically, in the 1970s, the city corporation demolished the Cavern Club, the famous club of the Beatles had played in the 60s, in order to make way for a ventilation shaft for an underground railroad.
Wow, that was farsighted, wasn't it?
I mean, crazy, right? It was never built because the city ran out of money. Whereas now, obviously, beginning in the 1980s and the 1990s, the Beatles have become an existential part of Liverpool's economy, right? It's like, the Beatles have had to sort of come to the rescue for the city's economy. In the 1960s, if fans ever made it to George Harrison's house, for example, they were invited in for tea and cake by his parents because so few people actually made it there. So part of the story I tell is obviously about the Beatles, but also how the city has used the Beatles in order to kind of remake its economy.
Now, it's obviously the week that said it. We don't want to mention the Trump word too much, but there is a connection in here, which is obviously Liverpool was mainly an industrial city, as you've mentioned, the docks, logistics, warehousing, all that stuff. At one time, in its darker history, of course, slavery played a big part in the history of it. But it then obviously became deindustrialized. A lot of resources moved to London and the southeast of the country. Has that been the biggest blow to the city, just this change in kind of business activity or economic activity where it got deindustrialized and you saw all those sort of brownfield sites and all the rest of it? Is that the biggest blow, or has there been other things going on beyond just that?
Well, I mean, I think that is the biggest blow. Obviously, you know, it's not the only story. I think the thing that's so striking about Liverpool's economic crisis that makes it a little bit, you know, different or more extreme than other places that went through the same process is how swiftly the city's economy unraveled. So from the mid-1960s, the idea of containerization, the idea that dock work would be replaced by identical steel shipping containers, was kind of gathering pace, but people weren't really paying attention to it. But within 5 years, this had bankrupted the port. And within 7 years, the entire 7 miles of docks running through the center of the city had to be effectively evacuated, creating this kind of very high profile, visible environmental crisis as these buildings rotted into the river effectively. And then at the same time, all of these light industrial plants, car plants in particular, that were created in order to offset this kind of slow unraveling of the docks were also just gutted by the recessions of the late 1970s and early 1980s. So in Liverpool, it's kind of about the drama and the speed of this unraveling that was so dramatic. And then also what I talk about is the fact that the consequences of this were very unequally felt and particularly brutally felt by the city's black community, who had throughout the 20th century often been excluded from, in the first place, from the forms of secure work and jobs that fell apart in the later 20th century. And this culminated in, you know, enormous amounts of police brutality, but also a huge uprising against the police in 1981. So for all of these reasons, it's kind of, that is the story, but it's extra dramatic in Liverpool, I would say.
Now, it obviously all blew, the whole thing blew up in the early 80s. We had the Toxted riots. Obviously, there was a lot of events bringing in Liverpool, as in the football club, not the city, into the news as well, Hillsborough and so on, Heysel Stadium. There was a lot of stuff around that hooliganism problem. I'm not saying that was the cause of those things, but certainly in terms of media coverage of the time. So was that, again, just when the city got too much, this economic decline just become very pronounced, or were there other factors that caused those events? You've mentioned racial tension as well, policing relations. What was it that made Liverpool kind of crack in the early 80s?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the best way into this actually is to think about the Hillsborough disaster, and which is obviously 1989, so it's over later 1980s, and Hillsborough marked the moment where the same kinds of forms of police violence and hostility and misunderstanding that had been meted out against the black community for more than a generation in Liverpool kind of came to be kind of born against the city's white communities. So the Hillsborough disaster was unambiguously the fault of the South Yorkshire police, who then orchestrated effectively a gigantic cover-up campaign in the days, weeks, months, years afterwards to try and draw attention away from the fact that this was absolutely unequivocally their fault, for every scale of the planning of this operation was a result of the police rather than the fans that were involved. And so, but one of the reasons why that was possible, one of the reasons why the fans were blamed for what happened, one of the reasons why lives had been cheapened to the point where social murder on this scale was so possible, was because of this longer process of deindustrialization and kind of pathologization of the city's population. So I kind of argue that actually the scale of this economic crisis had a kind of social effect as well that kind of ran through the city, but some of the racism against the black community was kind of contagious. It bled through the city's social order and allowed the violence of something like Hillsborough to be possible. So I would say that those two things, the social and the economic, are kind of linked in the story that I tell in the city.
Now, you always need, for any good story, and I'm sure your book is in this category, you need villains, right? And the villains that spring to mind immediately is most people you meet in Liverpool tend to go, the Tories, the Tories, the Tories. The Conservative Party has had a pretty uneasy relationship, let's say, including even Boris Johnson, who made pretty bad, strong comments about the city a few years ago. Is that fair? They obviously carry a fair bit of the blame, but obviously there are the city authorities themselves, there are local businesses, there are a few different characters, not just the Conservative Party, but where do they fit into your story?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of villains in my story, but there are lots of heroes as well. So I put a lot of blame and impetus on the Conservative Party, particularly in the 1980s. Unlike a lot of people who talk about Liverpool, I am unwilling to give Michael Heseltine a lot of credit for the remaking of the city and the regeneration of the docks, because this would never have happened had the 1981 uprising not happened, right? So the agency and the credit for Liverpool's regeneration, if we do think Liverpool's regeneration has been successful, and I'm on the fence about that, should go to the city's, you know, multiracial community that launched this uprising in 1981, arguably the most successful extra parliamentary protest in British history. But I would say that, you know, so I think there are lots of like, you know, I'd kind of rather talk about the heroes because I've been a little bit sort of, you know, I want to emphasize that there's a lot of hope in this book as well. And for me, the heroes are kind of everyday people in the city. So they are the extraordinary movement led by gay men in the city during the AIDS crisis to kind of look after each other and tend each other's bedsides after they've been abandoned by the healthcare service. The extraordinary imaginative anti-colonial activists that operated in the city in the 1950s. The wonderful feminist movements that organized rent strikes in the suburbs as the economy unraveled in places like Kirby and Speke. So these, for me, are actually, they're not just like heroes. They're places we need to look, actually, to think about our, you know, the way out of our present moment. They are places where, you know, as a historian, but also as a citizen, I find hope and joy in the city. And so I wanted to say that because it sounds like I'm being quite bleak, but I do, you know, I do believe this is a hopeful book at the end of the day.
And Sam, where does the whole the sort of Scouse identity play into all of this? Obviously, there's a whole history to that word and so on. But when you see, you know, a lot of the time, well, I shouldn't say a lot of the time, but occasionally the British national anthem is booed at Anfield. That gets a lot of media headlines. So it's always been a sense of a city detached, maybe arguably, from the rest of Britain. Now, maybe that's incorrect, but where does the whole sort of attachment and the sort of Scouse first and British second and all that idea, is that still the common currency of today, or is that something with big, long historical roots?
I mean, I think it does have big, long historical roots that actually go back to Liverpool being the centre of Irish migration in the 19th century to Britain. Obviously, it was the port of arrival for many Irish migrants, but it was also, I think, outside of London, had the second highest rates of settlement. You know, it was also the place whose politics was dominated by sort of anti-colonial Irish nationalism. Until well into the 20th century, Liverpool was the only place on mainland Britain to elect an Irish nationalist MP from the late 19th to the early 20th century. So there are deep roots of the city's associations with sort of anti-colonial movements in Ireland, but also further afield, West Africa in particular, even places, you know, there was a lot of activism in the Chinese community that looked quite similar. So it's, it has had this kind of cosmopolitan global horizon to the city, which has shaped that. But in terms of a more recent Scouse identity, I'm kind of, you know, I'm a little bit less interested in that, partly not because I don't think it's important, but because I want to, as I said at the beginning, emphasize the ways that we should see Liverpool as not exceptional, but actually as representative of a lot of the moments of British history that we need to look at now, right? So I think that, you know, we live in an age of you know, of new kinds of radical black consciousness from London to St. Louis. We also live in an age of environmental catastrophe. We live in an age of, you know, increasing insecurity at work and things like that, precarity. And so Liverpool is where we need to look to understand that. So my argument is more about how Liverpool is kind of part of the warp and weft of British history rather than something tangential to it.
Yeah, so bring it back into the foreground. A curious thing I want to ask about is the Sun newspaper has been boycotted for, I think, decades, really. Is that still current as far as you are aware? Obviously, it doesn't do particularly well. I know Jurgen Klopp wouldn't answer one of their journalist questions a few years ago, so there's still great animus there. But have you got any sense of where the Sun newspaper sits in the city of Liverpool? Is it as derided as ever, or has things changed?
I mean, I think so. And to be honest, I hope so. You know, the Sun's response to the Hillsborough disaster was absolutely revolting. Some of the most disgusting, you know, journalism, you know, published in the post-war period in Britain. Similarly, the Sun's response to the Toxteth uprising as well. And yeah, I mean, you know, the Sun is still colloquially and very rightly known as the scum in the city. Again, I think, as it should be, and unsurprisingly so. But there's an interesting side plot to this, which is that according to one political or a group of political scientists who have found that actually Liverpool has been less affected by the sort of global turn towards far right politics in post-industrial communities, you know, less affected by, say, the moment of Brexit or the moment of a Reform Party, partly potentially because no one buys the Sun in Liverpool. Like that has had a really
so it's a giant thought experiment. What happens to your city if you don't buy the Sun, right?
Okay. A meaningful effect on the city's politics, absolutely.
It's like a giant laboratory site. That's very interesting.
Totally, yeah.
Okay, listen, it's been a fascinating conversation. I said people from Liverpool, obviously very interested in your book, but as you've said, with those Irish antecedents and heritage, I think they'll also have an interest in it. And of course, there'll be the odd Liverpool and Everton fan thrown in as well, getting it for Christmas. But for the moment, thank you very much for joining us and taking stock. That's Sam Weatherall, author of Liverpool and the Unmaking of Britain. Now, that is it for this week's edition of Taking Stock. This has been Emmett Oliver presenting. I'll just remind you, of course, the show is available as a podcast first on Friday morning on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. And on research this week was Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you, of course, for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day.